Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a bug-filled program for you today, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll talk about the tragic killing of bumblebees in Portland, Oregon, and what should have been done to control pest insects instead. And in a very special interview, we are going to be dining on cricket fritters to preview an upcoming event in, quote, adventurous eating. That's a lot to get done, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Mary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Mary. How are you?
Hi, Mike. How are you? Long-time listener.
Well, thank you, sir. Where are you?
I'm in Weirtown, New Jersey. You know where that is?
Weirtown, New Jersey. That almost sounds like a knock-knock joke. Where are you? I'm in Weirtown. Where?
Yeah.
What?
That's right. It's halfway between somewhere and nowhere.
Yeah.
Exit 69, about 15 miles south of Tom's River.
Oh, okay. So what can we do for Mary in the basic vicinity of Tom's River?
Okay, well, I'm kind of, you know, in the Pine Barrens here, and I've been listening for years, and now you're not giving me any hints that can help me and millions of people like me. Your hints are for people that don't apply to me, because I live in a highly restricted, you know, gated community.
Oh.
And I can't do any composting, specifically in our regulations. Not allowed to do any composting. We don't cut our own grass, and we don't get the clippings. It all disappears in these big machines. And I have a beautiful house and a beautiful garden, a beautiful community. In fact, I'm outside right now, sitting under the awning, watching the golf course and watching my flowers and vegetables, but struggling to keep it nice.
First of all, in terms of these communities, you're a little bit better off than a lot of people who contact me, Murr, because some of them aren't even allowed to have their own gardens.
I know we are restricted into the vegetables that you can grow because they don't want anything that's growing too high or attracting animals. Yeah.
This is so important for people to understand before they buy into timeshares, before they move into a over 55 community, that they have to understand that their gardening may be restricted and that there might be lawns right outside their house that are going to be heavily treated with chemicals, and they won't have any say about it. I will make you incredibly jealous and tell you that there is a community like this just outside of Princeton in a place called Lawrenceville that actually hired me years ago to turn the landscaping upside down, and they have a completely organic lawn care program and are encouraging people to plant more of a variety of things around their house. Now, they are...
I don't mean to interrupt you. This is a beautiful community on a beautiful golf course, and you take the good with the bad.
Right.
I didn't understand all the ramifications when I came in, you know.
But I'm going to tell you how you can cheat, Murray.
Go ahead.
Instead of an outdoor compost bin, which would be very obvious, you sound like a guy who eats a lot of fresh food, right?
Yep.
Get a worm bin and keep it inside your house. And
I have 3 5-gallon buckets on my patio, which I put whatever vegetables and coffee grinds, and I mix it with soil, and I have 3 gallons, and the worms love that, and I use it, but it's not enough for all my needs.
Okay, so you're kind of trying to compost without being seen, and the worms that are involved, did you buy red worms, or are you just letting earthworms?
Whatever the soil I mixed with my grinds have done very well, and I have lots of worms in there, and I produce 15 gallons of compost, you know.
Well, Mary, how are you getting away with these 5-gallon buckets outside? I'm going to turn you in, man.
they're under the chairs on the patio.
I have a unit that's called the Worm Factory, and this is stackable trays. It's meant to be indoors. It doesn't take up a lot of room. It's like a 2-foot footprint, but it goes up. The trays stack on top of each other, and you can make a monumental amount of compost.
Can that be kept in the dark, or they have to have some light?
No, they don't need to. No, they just want to be in an environment that never gets freezing cold or super hot. They like darkness. You take a tray, you fill it with garbage, and then on top of that, you put some shredded newspaper and you wet it down. You put that on top. You take the tray from the bottom. That'll be finished. You go throw that on your plants outside. And I thought it would be a slow process. But after they got established, after they got used to being in the house, the worms are like egging us on to eat more salads. They want more leftovers.
Well, I'm going to try that because I have a furnace room that's upstairs. It's a big room with a furnace and air conditioning units are, and it's, you know, it's cool in the wintertime. It's warm in the summer, not cold.
Right.
Not real cold, so I'm going to give that a try.
I was skeptical myself, Murray, but these worm bins are the bee's knees, and I really recommend the style that's known as the worm factory, the stackable. Okay. It just makes it so easy to harvest, to use, and nobody will know you're doing it.
Sometime when you're in the area, give me a call, and I'll show you my very pretty little garden.
Excellent, excellent.
And I'll give you some fresh figs because I grow figs here, too.
Very good. All right, Murray, you have a successful summer, man.
Thank you, man.
1-888-346-9499. Brenda, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thank you. Brenda, where are you?
Media, Pennsylvania.
Very good. What can we do for Brenda in Media?
I was given a jack in the pulpit by some friends, and then last year I was given another one, and each time I've tried, it seems to be dying, and I'm not sure if I'm giving it too much water, not enough sun, too much sun. I'm trying to figure out kind of what they need.
Well, the jack in the pulpit is kind of like the American name. When this is sold as a house plant, it's typically called the cobra lily. Does yours have that kind of a cobra-ish hood?
Yes.
And they're relives of Canna and calla lilies. And I'm trying to think of the house plant. Did you get a species name? Did they call it anything other than jack in the pulpit?
A peace lily, maybe? Something along that line.
Oh, the peace lily is an entirely different plant.
Okay.
But it does have that same habit. Do you have a black thumb with house plants here?
Not normally, but for some reason with this plant, I can't seem to keep it alive.
Okay, what do you got it in?
It came in a weave basket, and then there's a plastic container around it. And I've tried putting it in a corner where there's little sun. I've tried putting it in front of a sliding glass door. I've tried various places in the house to keep it.
It sounds to me, first of all, like it may have come in a presentation state. Have you taken it apart? Have you taken it out of the basket and looked to see what it's actually planted in?
No.
Okay. Because it might have come so that it could be sold in like a floral shop or a supermarket and not get the floral wet. But it may be in a container that has no drainage holes.
Okay. I'll try that.
So I think you have to examine it. You have to take it out. A lot of times these house plants that come in wicker baskets, it's just for presentation. And what they don't tell you is you have to manipulate what's inside quite a bit if you want to keep the poor thing alive. So when you water it, does water come out the bottom?
It has.
Okay, so we know there's drainage holes in there. How often are you watering it?
I was watering it like once a week pretty well, but I've slowed down, and that seems to help it a lot.
Yeah. These are mostly plants that are, put them in the right spot and forget them, maybe watering once a month, something like that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And bright light, but indirect light. I think that the peace lily burns if it gets the direct light of the sun. The leaves would start to get...
That's what I've seen happen.
And you've been giving it a lot of sun, right?
I had been, yes,
yeah.
But I've since moved it, and it seems to be doing better. I haven't been giving it as much water or as much sun, and it seems to be doing a little bit better.
Yes, most times we have to remember that when people give us houseplants, these things were kind of bred to get by indoors, not with a, you know, without a ton of light. And so much so that a lot of times when they get direct light, it's too much for them. So with most houseplants, although not all, there's always exceptions, The general rule is bright light, but no direct sunlight. And watering, you need to go by the needs of the plant. But, you know, things like peace lily, snake plant, mother-in-law's tongue, these are things that are bred or that have the ability to go a long time in between waterings. And it's easier to revive a dry plant than it is a drowned one. So be brave. Take it outside on a cloudy day. Take it apart. See what it's kind of planted in. If you're comfortable, if it's in soil that's in like a plastic container that has drainage holes, that's fine. Water it more lightly. Keep it out of direct sun, and it should bounce back. Either that or you'll do great with the third one.
Okay. Sounds good. I'll try that.
All right, Brenda. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind lawn owners with Cool Season Turf, that's bluegrass, fescue, and or rye, that we are now officially in the season of no feeding. So if you're on a 4-step program, get on a 12-step program, because summer feedings can only damage cool season lawns. Now, don't go looking for all the whys and wherefores under L for lawn care and the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, the story behind the bumblebee tragedy in Portland, Oregon, and yes, I will eat some bugs on the air. I'm bug-eating Mike McGrath, and yes, this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee is dedicated to providing all things needed for planting and growing gardens. Information, instructions, supplies, and more online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we're going to discuss why 50,000 bumblebees recently perished in Portland and what should have been done to protect them. We'll also take lots of your fabulous phone calls. But now we're going to look at insects in a totally different manner. There is an upcoming event at the Morris Arboretum of the University of Pennsylvania, which piqued my interest. Rather than a pub crawl, they're calling this a bug crawl, and they are going to be eating bugs, gourmet bugs, we are led to believe, if such a thing is indeed possible, on July 17th, on the evening of July 17th, billed as an evening of adventurous eating. And here to talk with us about the fun and frivolity of cooking insects is Chef Josh Hunter of Companies Coming Catering, who has been providing the catering at the Morris Arboretum for, I believe, a decade now. Right, Josh?
Yes, sir.
Good for you. Is this your first adventure into bug eating?
Yes, it is.
Now, in your culinary training, Did you ever come across anyone who discussed this? Because this is not uncommon. There are like societies of strange people who get together and have bug dinners and things like this.
You know, it was discussed a little bit. Bugs as ingredients in food. In culinary school, we talked about the Casamarzu cheese from Sicily where it has maggots in it. But, you know, generally they're sort of...
We just lost half the audience there, Josh. I was kind of hoping we wouldn't chase them away until... And people like this cheese.
Oh, it's a delicacy.
It's a delicacy. I guess if you call it a delicacy, it can be anything. Because I would have imagined in culinary school, they would have told you to avoid insects in the kitchen.
Yeah, at all costs, usually, yes.
What did you do to prepare for this event?
Well, I read a few books, and we've done some experimental cooking at the restaurant. Looked over menus that we found online and in cookbooks, and I think we've come up with a pretty solid sampling of bugs that people won't find too offensive, and hopefully they're able to eat at our event. So.
Now, is this an American problem, the concept of eating this enormous abundance of protein just because it has six legs? Because certainly there are paleontologists who believe we developed our big brains largely by eating protein sources like bugs, and there's still societies where I believe ants are eaten, and especially locusts, correct?
Oh, absolutely.
Grasshoppers and locusts, which are the same kind of creature, which is kind of interesting because in these communities, the grasshoppers and locusts are devouring the crops, so it only seems fair play.
Turnabout, yeah. There's cultures in Mexico that eat jamiles, which are little bugs that they sell on roadside stands that taste like tutti frutti candy, apparently. And I think mainly developed countries tend to stray away from eating bugs when there is much more handsome forms of protein. But as, you know, our environmental resources dwindle, this is a responsible way to get protein in your diet.
Now, when you were researching this, did you find the same insects over and over again in recipes?
A lot of grasshopper recipes, a lot of crickets, mealyworms. I had to really dig deep because the people at the Arboretum had asked me to come up with five different stations.
Ooh, that's tough.
So, yeah, I mean, we could have done chocolate-covered crickets and called it a day. But no.
Will you be serving chocolate-covered crickets?
No, we will not. Yeah, we're trying to keep this a little more sophisticated for the evening. So.
And where are you getting your raw ingredients? I was in Whole Foods today, and I couldn't find the insect section.
They're actually going to be coming live to us from an organic insect farm called Fluker Farms down south.
I've heard of them. Do they perhaps provide crickets for people who have pet frogs and toads and other creatures that need to eat live crickets?
Mm-hmm. But they've started feeding them on a diet that's completely organic so that it's safe for human consumption.
All right. I see our producer, Alexis Landis, outside the studio. You have brought a tray of what I believe is cricket fritters and some sauces and stuff. And thank you, Alexis. Lovely presentation here. These look like chicken McNuggets. And what do you suggest? That I dip it into the sauce and then squeeze lime or what?
Yeah, you know, a little bit of lime and some of the coconut sauce on there.
Let me try it just with the coconut sauce. I apologize moving off mic here. We're eating on air. It doesn't look like bugs. It looks like a little meatball, a little fritter thing. I'm just going all in. I hate to say this, ladies and gentlemen. I hate to say this to our chef here, but this is delicious.
Oh, thank you.
Mm. Here's our intern, Jolie.
Oh, no.
Jolie, just here. And see, they look. Go ahead and dip it in the dipping sauce.
Can I try the lime?
You can try the lime, sure. What, you know,
oh, wow.
It's a wild day here at the You Bet Your Garden studio. Now, Josh, what else are you going to be serving while we're eating cricket here? These crickets are going to be gone, man.
We're going to be serving the cricket fritters with the coconut curry dipping sauce, mealworm French fries with smoked sea salt and spicy tomato ketchup.
And that's one of the most common things that people eat at these insect events, right?
Are the mealyworms,
yeah.
So they'll sort of be sprinkled on amongst the salt. So,
right.
Then, for the more bold guest, we're going to have a grill your own giant hissing teriyaki glazed cockroach station.
Okay, I'm off. I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm totally out.
That one we're not going to order so many cockroaches
for. And have you tested some cockroaches.
I had one, yeah. Last week in preparation for this.
How'd it go?
It's a unique flavor. And then there's bamboo worm bruschetta and silkworm pupae summer rolls, and they're going to go on a cucumber crescent. So.
And adult beverages will be involved.
Yes, we're going to have beer and wine paired with each of the dishes at all the stations.
So are these beers and wines named after insects, or you just decided this is, for instance, you're saying what I'm eating here that I said looked like a chicken McNugget that is a cricket fritter.
Yes.
You know, in many cultures is referred to like as a shrimp substitute.
Right.
So are you going to serve like a beer or wine you would have with shrimp?
If I was to serve a beer with that, I would think maybe like a Belgian Golden Strong Ale or a triple, something, you know.
I'm thinking a Qingdao.
Yeah, with some acid to it. Absolutely.
So this is upcoming at the Morris Arboretum on July 17th in the evening, 6 o'clock. And it's in conjunction with their exhibit, which they've been running for a couple of years now, spectacularly popular. And we love it because it gives us a great image to put on our website in the events section. And that's the big bugs.
Right.
Where they have these 12 and 14 foot sculptures of like ants and praying mantis and everything.
Right. Yeah. They're all made out of natural and found materials. So they're very beautiful too, by the way.
So were you able to adapt pre-existing sauces? Was that the easiest part?
For the most part, the way we looked at these menu items, we took the insect ingredients and tasted them in their natural state to see what they were most similar to, and then sort of folded them into recipes that were pre-existing.
You didn't eat any live bugs, did you?
No. I mean, just blanched or roasted, yeah.
Okay.
Without unadulterated bugs, we'll put it that way.
Sure. Unspiced, unseasoned. You know.
Absolutely.
But cooked. Cooked. Yes. You didn't eat no raw bugs.
No, no. I don't recommend eating raw bugs.
But there are people who do, right?
Oh, absolutely.
At these things, right?
Sure.
What was your reaction when they first came to you? Did you try to run away and hide? Did you fake a seizure? Did you go, I'll do my best?
I was a little hesitant at first because, you know, as a caterer, you don't want to get pigeonholed into a certain type of cuisine. But you know, I enjoy all the challenges they throw at me, and I just looked at this as another, you know, thing to try out and succeed at. So
now that you have, and I'm a picky eater. I'm a fussy eater. I am not really an adventurous eater. I'm very proud of myself, actually. You know, the only reason I'm not finishing this list, last fritters, I think it's probably chilled down. The warmth, oh, the mouthfeel of these things, really exceptional. I would order this now in a restaurant.
Oh, wow, thank you.
You said you went online and got the recipes and stuff, and I presume the bugs themselves were not hard to find once you found that supplier.
Right.
Can this be done at home?
Oh, absolutely. This recipe for cricket fritters can be found in the last issue of the Weaver's Way newspaper.
Oh, Weaver's Way is a long-time co-op in the Philadelphia area.
Yes, absolutely.
And so you get your crickets, you prepare them, which we'll dance around right now, and then you batter them up. Were they deep-fried?
Yes, they were.
Okay, so everything tastes better deep fried.
Absolutely.
But then, I mean, where most people are going to fall down, and this seems almost superfluous, is the sauce.
Right, and the sauce is very simple. It's an apricot curry dipping sauce. We use a little bit of apricot preserves, some coconut milk, hot Madras curry powder, and a pinch of garam masala, and that's about it.
Well, I am pleasantly surprised. I can now say that I ate a cricket to be a good sport, and then I ate like five more because they were absolutely delicious. How many crickets per fritter?
Well, let's see. For that batch that we did there, and I think there was about a dozen of them, there were three dozen crickets.
Okay. Chef Josh Hunter of Companies Coming Catering will be serving all sorts of tasty insect hors d'oeuvres at the Morris Arboretum at the University of Pennsylvania, which is located in Chestnut Hill, on July 17th in an evening of adventurous eating called the Bug Crawl. We'll have information about it up at the events section of our website. Chef Josh, thanks so much for coming in today. This was really delightful.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. But Lois, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, how are you, Mike?
Good, good. Am I getting your name correct?
Yes, yes, you are, Lois. That's correct. Oh. I live in Eastern North Carolina.
Okay.
Small town, not too far from Greenville.
Oh, okay. Very good. What can we do for you, Lois?
Well, Mike, for years and years, I have had the most beautiful impatiens. I grow them on the north side of my home in filtered light, and they have always just been absolutely gorgeous. But for the last 3 years, I don't know if an insect is cutting them off at the root or if they're just rotting and falling over. But all of a sudden, I can't grow them anymore. I thought perhaps it was something in my soil. So I cleaned out my pots last year, Cloroxed them, left them out in the sun all winter, and started with fresh soil. But I'm having the same problem again.
Well,
and I can't imagine what it is. I don't see any insects.
Oh, I know what it is.
What?
There's been a lot of talk about some diseases like the late blight on tomatoes causing real problems. And we have discussed this on previous shows, but it still seems to be flying under the radar. And even though many nurseries were kind of prompted not to be selling lots of regular impatiens, many did so anyway. So beginning just about 3 years ago, as you noted, there was a massive die-off of impatiens. And this happens so quickly. And no gardener understood what was happening. Literally, and it happened to me. So I know exactly what went wrong. And I thought the same thing you did. I, for instance, thought it was slugs eating my impatiens because the first day's damage looked exactly the same. You know, I went to bed with normal impatiens, with little stalks, you know, those kind of watery stalks with the flowers on the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I woke up in the morning and all the flowers were gone. And it was just those stalks. And to me, that's slug damage on a stick. So I put out little beer traps. I spread the sluggo and escargot, which is the iron phosphate and the yeasty bait. And the next morning, my plants were just gone, as if somebody had just come and disappeared them. And I didn't know what happened. And then at the very end of that season, a farmer I knew sent me an email, said, "Hey, how come you haven't talked about the impatiens blight on your show?" And that's when I got a hold of Cornell University, and they told me that it had wiped out 90% of the impatiens on the East Coast. And the next year happened the same. And this year, we were led to believe that people would be producing fewer impatiens for the bedding plant trade for two reasons. First, it's kind of cruel to know there's a blight out there and to sell people plants that have a high risk of just disappearing almost overnight. But the other would be the good news, that if no one grew impatiens for like 3 or 4 years, the blight would have nothing to feed on, would have no way to reproduce, and it would go away and we could grow impatiens again. But right now,
does it have anything to do with super elfin or just ordinary, you know, impatiens?
It has to do with the dirt, ordinary, basic impatiens. What's interesting is there is a subgroup called sunpatiens, which were bred to take a little more light than the basic impatient. They don't catch the blight. And New Guinea impatiens, which are a variation of the basic form, they don't get the blight. Just the basic bedding plant, dirt simple impatien. But of course, you know, that makes up most of the impatiens in the bedding plant trade. And, you know, people with shade depend on like the Holy Trinity, the coward shade garden, impatiens, begonias, and hostas.
Why?
So you've done nothing wrong. You won't be able to grow in patience for a couple of years. Don't use Clorox, by the way, in the future. There's no reason to ever use bleach, and bleach is really dangerous to get on the ground and in your skin and inhale. If you really think you got something that's got some disease on it, just use a little white vinegar to clean it up.
Okay.
But for now, stick with begonias, New Guinean patiens, sun patiens. And if you go to our website or even go to any good gardening website and type in impatient options now, there's a whole list of underutilized bedding plants for shade that we can use to fill in these spots until the blight is gone.
Okay.
But you did nothing wrong. There's nothing bad. You don't have any bad insects. There's nothing really bad in your soil. There is a disease blowing around in the air. The spores are everywhere, and they nailed everybody, good gardeners, bad gardeners alike.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
I have tried everything.
My pleasure. Okay. I'm sure there were a lot of people scratching their heads, and you helped them out to it today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy your program. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind you that they're going to be serving the bugs we discussed and tasted earlier in the show at the Morris Arboretum of the University of Pennsylvania in Chestnut Hill from 6 to 8 p.m. on Wednesday, July 17th. The evening of adventurous eating will include beer and wine, specially chosen to complement the evening's menu. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be back with more of your fabulous phone calls and the sad story of the bumblebees in Portland, Oregon. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee is dedicated to providing all things needed for planting and growing gardens. Information, instructions, supplies, and more online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, which will be an examination of the tragedy, the bumblebee devastation that recently occurred in Portland, Oregon, and how it could have been avoided. In the meantime, though, a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Todd, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Mike.
Well, thanks for being had, Todd. Where are you, man?
I am in Brookhaven, Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Todd in Brookhaven?
Well, I just dug up some daffodil bulbs that are in my backyard. And right next to the row of daffodil bulbs, I also dug up some very small looking daffodil bulbs, and I have two questions. One is, when should I replant my daffodil bulbs? so that they will bloom next spring? And the second question is, are those little baby daffodil bulbs that I dug up next to them?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. They're called offsets. And this is how these plants reproduce. They mostly reproduce underground. Little bulbs form off of the mother bulb. And in nature, you know, every year they'll just get bigger and bigger. And then finally, when they get to mature enough size, they'll actually produce their own flower. And this is how daffodils especially, quote, naturalize. They not only perennialize, that is, come back from year to year, but they increase in number over time. They love making these offsets. So now I'm very interested because I pull my spring bulbs out in the late spring after their foliage has turned brown because I want to plant annual flowers over top of that. Why did you dig up your daffodil bulbs?
I dug up my daffodil bulbs because I was building a shed, and I right at the spot where my daffodils were growing, so I wanted to dig them up and move them to a new location. I usually don't dig them up every year. They've been there for probably 20 years.
Okay. That's fine. That's a good enough reason. And when you dug them up, all of their foliage had turned brown, right?
Correct.
Okay, good. And where are they now? Are they in a cardboard box in a garage or something? What's going on?
Exactly. Cardboard box garage.
Okay, so some people would tell you to pack them in soil-free mix or peat moss or something like that. I just pile them up in big cardboard boxes, and I pull mine up because I have very limited garden space, and I know that my spring bulbs will last longer, more and more years, especially the tulips. If I dig them up when they're all done for the season, then I can plant whatever I want over top, and then I plant them again fresh in the fall. If I left them in the ground, and then planted stuff over top of them and heavily watered those new plants and everything, I would rot some of the bulbs underground.
I see.
So this is actually, you accidentally did a technique that many advanced gardeners have learned from people like Anna Prevord, the famous bulb writer who taught it to me on the show like a decade ago. So just keep them cool and dry. Don't let them be exposed to direct sunlight.
Okay.
Again, if you want to put some soil-free mix or peat moss around them, that's fine, but you don't have to. And then you would plant them at the ideal time to plant new spring bulbs in our region, which is after Halloween, but before Thanksgiving. That's the perfect timing to put spring bulbs in the ground.
Okay, wonderful. And those little bulbs, can I plant those as well?
Yes, they will not produce little flowers. Wouldn't that be nice?
But that would be great.
But what they will do is they will produce little leaves. And then if there's some food in the soil, like if the soil is compost enriched and they get a lot of sunlight and the leaves are allowed to die off naturally, like the mother plants, they will get bigger. So over a course of, say, 3 to 4 years, depending on how big they are now, they'll get big enough to produce flowers. So you may want to make a little nurse bed off to the side to bring these things up to size and everything.
Oh, wonderful.
But
okay.
this is how the Dutch grow out the bulbs. They have like this 5-year plan. They take these little bulblets, these little offsets, and, you know, grow them knowing they're only going to get leaves, and then when they finally get big enough, they sell them to people like you and me.
Wonderful.
All right, man?
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
All right. Good luck, Todd.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Rick, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing good, Rick.
You know my name. I'm from Lacey Township. That's in New Jersey.
Oh.
And I've been told to call you for a long time by somebody I work with.
Okay.
So I figured I'd give you a call and ask you a question about composting.
Okay, proceed.
All right. So I was listening to you this weekend, and I heard you talking to a gentleman about composting and tomatoes, and I'm having a problem with my tomatoes. I have great green plants. I've been composting using my grass clippings and some horse manure.
Okay, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Are there any fall leaves in the mix?
Very little.
Okay. Grass clippings from a treated lawn?
No, sir.
Okay, so it's an untreated lawn.
Untreated. I use organic fertilizer, and that's about it.
Okay, good, good. But whatever compelled you to mix grass clippings and horse manure?
Well, I'm kind of mixing everything, kitchen scraps and my grass clippings. I thought that the nitrogen would be good for the tomatoes.
And you are the kind of guy who buys a gas grill in the box, and you take it home and you assemble it. And then when you're done and the legs aren't straight and there's six parts left over, then you look at the directions, right? Have I pegged Rick correctly here?
No, sometimes. Okay, you know what? Mate, I'll give you that one.
Your, quote, compost is a nitrogen bomb.
Okay.
It is all nitrogen. And nitrogen grows big, healthy, good-looking plants. But when the soil is overwhelmed with nitrogen alone, you get big, gigantic, good-looking plants with no fruits or flowers.
Okay.
Especially the horse manure part. People who use composted horse manure, having heard, oh, my grandfather used horse manure and had the greatest tomatoes, they wind up with the classic 50-foot tomato plant with two tomatoes on it. Your grass clippings are even more nitrogen intense than the horse manure was. Your compost would be great at feeding a lawn, at growing sweet corn. It would be great for things that don't fruit and flower. But you are absolutely inhibiting the flowering. You need to stop using that compost and go out and get a nice balanced organic fertilizer, something with a high middle number. And when I say high, like a 6 or an 8, something that has a lot of phosphorus, that might try to balance things out and help your plants regain the ability to fruit. They don't need to be fed anymore. They are already overfed, but they've been fed a very imbalanced diet. Come fall, I want you to save and shred every leaf, every deciduous leaf, every leaf from a deciduous tree. That is what should be the bulk of your compost. That should be 80% of your raw ingredients.
Wow. Okay, yeah, I'm the opposite.
Into that, you can mix some horse manure. That would be fine.
Okay.
Shredded fall leaves and horse manure will make an excellent compost. The grass clippings need to stay on the lawn.
All right.
Even though you are being a good man and you're not using herbicides, so that means which is good, because if you had been using tainted grass clippings, your plants might be dead. Instead, they're just too tall. But every time you take the clippings away from your lawn, you're starving your lawn, because those clippings are the perfect food for your lawn. So you don't want to remove the grass clippings.
I only bag once in a while, Mike, just for the compost, and that's it. I typically mulch the grass clippings.
Good, good. So make it 100%. Because if you have access to horse manure, you have all the nitrogen-rich component you need.
And I don't need the clippings.
Correct. Somebody who didn't have access to horse manure, it might make sense to take one run of clippings and mix them in real well. Better to actually cut a lawn that has leaves on it and, you know, bag that up as your compost ingredient. But when you have access to horse manure, you don't need any grass clippings. Leave them all on your lawn. Your lawn will look even better than it does now. And composted horse manure and shredded fall leaves, you will make perfect compost that has balanced nutrition. And what you grow in that in the future, it'll be perfect for every plant.
Great. Mike, thank you so much, sir. I really appreciate it.
All right. My pleasure, Rick. Good luck, sir.
All right. Have a great day.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, which once again is kind of a dialogue of the week. We're going to explain why no bumblebees had to die. Aphids are easy to control. Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer, please introduce this week's timely topic.
Mike, the recent mass killing of bumblebees in Portland, Oregon, has a lot of our listeners really upset. What can you tell us about what happened?
Well, I just spoke with Rich Hatfield, an endangered species conservation biologist for the Xerces Society, a group dedicated to protecting pollinators and other invertebrates. Their headquarters is in Portland, where this incident took place. It happened on a Saturday, and when Rich and his co-workers came into the office on Monday morning, there were several messages from concerned citizens who had tried to reach them over the weekend.
What were people saying?
That bees were literally falling out of the trees in a local parking lot. Rich went to the scene and found thousands of dead bees on the ground, with bees still literally falling out of the trees.
Well, what did Rich do?
He immediately called the Oregon Department of Agriculture, whose response was really impressive. They came out right away, saw the carnage, tested some of the dead bees, and quickly identified the pesticide that was responsible. The trees were then even covered with netting to try and prevent more bees from reaching them. Rich really praised the Ag Department's response. They clearly took the situation very seriously, as they should. This massive kill-off is near important agricultural areas that depend on the pollination these bees provide, or at least used to provide.
What kind of trees were in the parking lot?
Well, the parking lot contains around 55 lindens, which Jeff Myers, the tree book, describes as an excellent shade tree with unique heart-shaped leaves and an abundance of fragrant flowers that open in June and attract a large following of honeybees. Beekeepers love having these trees around. Rich from the Xerces Society told me that a Portland beekeeper says he gets an astounding 50 to 100 pounds of honey from the bloom of a single mature linden tree.
And these trees are in a parking lot?
Yeah, it's very ironic. They're not the normal parking lot tree. Rich said that before the spraying, the landscaping around this store had been incredibly beneficial for local pollinators and beneficial insects.
So you're saying someone sprayed the trees?
A landscaper hired by the company that manages the property sprayed the trees because they supposedly had aphids. Large numbers of aphids can secrete a sticky black honeydew that one supposes people were concerned about dripping onto nearby cars. But the store where this happened said that nobody had complained to them. They lease the property, and the person who owns it is the one who ordered they spraying.
Oh, okay. Well, what did they use?
They used the worst thing possible, an insecticide known as Safari, which is one of these neonicotinoids, pesticides that have a nicotine-like effect on insects, essentially exciting them to death. This is the exact same class of chemicals that's been heavily implicated in the colony collapse disorder that's devastating honeybee populations. The label clearly says that it's toxic to bees and that it shouldn't be sprayed on plants while they're in bloom, and yet it was sprayed into trees that were obviously covered with flowers and bees. Rich called the site when he arrived a horrific scene. Right now, the death toll is estimated to be around 50,000 bumblebees, most of which were a specific species called the yellow-faced bumblebee. There were also some ladybugs, which of course were helping naturally control any aphids, and some honeybees. And a local beekeeper recently told Rich that the hives he has, which are located about a half a mile away, don't look too good.
If the aphids were a problem, what should they have used?
Pressure washers. A classic study found that sharp streams of water were more effective at aphid control than the use of actual pesticides. The water blasts these little sapsuckers right off the plant so effectively, you get a 90 to 95% knockdown.
Oh, yeah, that's what you've been telling our listeners for years. If you have aphids on your roses, get a nozzle that delivers a sharp stream of water.
And just blast them off. Water is the best pesticide of all. You just have to know how to use it. Now, insecticidal soap sprays are also effective against aphids, as are light horticultural oils. And if you apply these treatments at night while the bees aren't feeding, there won't be any collateral damage, as soap and oil are only deadly when they coat and suffocate the pest insect. There's no poison involved, so bees that show up the next day to pollinate wouldn't be in any danger.
So many pesticides are toxic to bees, and bees are so important to our survival. Do you think this might be a wake-up call that will make people think more about the dangers of pesticides?
I sure hope so. Otherwise, 50,000 bumblebees just died in vain. And you know what we always say? No bees, no food. Well, that sure was a sad tale of bumblebee destruction, now wasn't it? The question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. So if you'd like to read this over in detail, with links to articles about this tragic occurrence and some additional comments from Common Sense pest control expert Bill Quarles, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to make me eat more bugs if I don't get out of this studio. I'd say that's not a bad thing, but they're all cold now and I want to warm them up. We must be out of time, but you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check voiced to see if the information you seek is already waiting at the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can also listen to this show, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Charlie Kyer. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at our Facebook page. Either joining or looking on with bug eyes in my daring dining adventure were our editor, Al Banks, our interns, Jolie Higazi and Cecily Garber, and Alexis, I used to be a vegetarian, Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm omnivorous Mike McGrath, and I'll see you again next week. Is a garden filled with wasps always a bad thing? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a close look at some of nature's most fascinating and frightening-looking creatures. Plus your fabulous phone calls.